Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, November 23rd. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Saratoga Hospital, introducing Mako Robotic Arm Assisted Surgery, the latest joint replacement technology at Saratoga Hospital. SaratogaHospital.org to learn more. Joining us on the line today is Dr. Jeremy Stopker, a family practice physician at Community Health Programs in the Berkshires. He is here to answer all of your family medicine questions. And we advise you to call early on this Medical Monday. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email some questions, keep them brief but detailed, to voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jeremy Stopker and your calls coming up after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Dr. Jeremy Stopker, a family practice physician at Community Health Programs in the Berkshires, joins us on the line today. Dr. Stopker graduated from Georgetown University School of Medicine in Washington. Most recently, Stopker was a teaching and attending physician at the Center for Family and Community Medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. He also worked as a private practitioner at Westside Family Medicine in New York City. Dr. Stopker has a special interest in providing a safe zone for LGBTQ health, as well as alternative and complementary medicine approaches. If you have a question about family medicine or any of those things we discussed, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jeremy Stopker, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me again, Ray. It's great to be here.
Great to have you back. Now, the last time you were on with me, I know you were on in the summer. I think I was on summer vacation, but you were on in October of 2019, and that was pre-pandemic. You came to the studio. We haven't had too many guests since then, and our world has changed here in broadcasting. How has being someone who is in a family practice setting every day changed with the COVID pandemic?
Well, it's a really scary time. So I think the things that we're dealing with on a regular everyday basis have changed pretty dramatically. The COVID pandemic has triggered a pretty significant mental health. I think someone referred to this as a twindemic, which is a word I really liked. And so that's come up a lot. But in terms of the logistics, yeah, we're doing things a lot differently. Number one, I don't get to see most of each of my patients' faces, and they don't get to see most of my face unless I'm seeing them on Zoom. In a weird way, sometimes it can be more personal because we can take our masks off to meet with me looking at an iPad and them looking at whatever screen they're looking at me on. So we're doing a lot of telemedicine, which I think has actually been great.
Do you think telemedicine, and I've asked this of many a doctor on this program since the pandemic began, do you think this telemedicine, which was in some ways not frowned upon, but it certainly wasn't at the forefront pre-pandemic, HIPAA rules and otherwise, I have no idea what the reasoning was, but it has now jumped to the forefront. Do you think telemedicine is with us in a big way forever?
You know, ultimately, I think that will be up to policymakers more than it's up to us. But I love every chance I get to nudge those debates in the direction that I think is best for patients. And I do think having the availability of telemedicine is best for patients. I think the more ways primary care and specialty care providers can be available to patients, the more we can reduce barriers to that care, the better off everyone is. And there's pretty good data to back that up. If people are plugged in well to a primary care provider, it saves the healthcare system money. It makes them more healthy. They live longer, happier lives. And I think this is just yet another tool to make that easier. So reducing geographic barriers. Where I'm working now, we see a really broad set of folks across the socioeconomic spectrum. And for some people, it's actually really hard to even just get a ride to see me at my clinic. And we're not in a place that a lot of people can walk to. So if I can just talk to them on the phone instead of them having to come in, All of a sudden, it's easier for me to follow up on whatever it is that we're following up on, and they get more engaged, they get better care, hopefully they get better. If I'm doing my job right. Anything we can do to make access better is great. Do I think it's the ideal? No. I don't think it should by any means replace, but I don't think anyone's proposing that. I hope no one's proposing that. I think it's just nice to have as yet another option.
We're joined today by Dr. Jeremy Stopker, a family practice physician at Community Health Programs in the Berkshires. All that is well and good, and I've seen firsthand how this works, the telemedicine, but from your angle, are outcomes any better than they were when everybody came in?
I don't know if we have enough data for me personally to weigh in or for the research to back this up. I think people are better connected, and my impression is that patients really like it a lot and seem to be doing better with the additional ability to connect with us. And I think there's going to be some populations that it's particularly good for, maybe people with transportation problems, maybe people who live in a place that don't have a lot of doctors near them, maybe people who just need to follow up quite a bit, and it's a hassle to continue to go to a place where that is, or who live out in the middle of nowhere. So I can't fathom a scenario where it wouldn't be beneficial in some ways. Is it detrimental in some ways? Sure, of course. You're much less connected to a person when you're staring at them on a screen. Am I potentially going to miss things that I would have been able to diagnose in person, right? If I, the resolution on the screen is terrible and I'm trying to look at a rash and I'm not really sure what it looks like, then maybe I'm going to get that wrong. But if you look at the statistics, I'm probably going to get that rash wrong a few times anyway, whether I see it in person or whether I see it on a screen. I think one of the most challenging parts of being a family physician or seeing a family physician as a patient is that we get things wrong a fair amount of the time, but eventually, hopefully, you stick with it. You keep coming back if whatever you tried didn't work. You keep trying different things, or you get plugged in with different providers or different specialists, and eventually you get to a place where you have some resolution or improvement in whatever it is that you're working on. And I think, again, having more access to the primary care provider, having access to specialists. You know, I practice in Berkshire County, and we have really limited access to specialists here. And if all of a sudden my patients can see or at least talk to any provider within their entire network without having to travel all the way to Springfield or to Worcester or to Boston to meet with one of those providers, that's huge for us. You know, all of a sudden I have 50 different specialists per field that I can refer to instead of just the one or two local who are maybe really backed up, especially with the pandemic and how it's limited access. You know, doctor's offices have been seeing fewer patients. And so wait lists, I think, for a lot of things have gone up. Certainly wait lists for mental health in our area have gone way up. And if all of a sudden a patient can see a therapist anywhere in the state or anywhere in the nation, instead of being restricted just to people who they can drive to within 15 minutes, that's amazing. And, you know, you brought up very briefly earlier why we hadn't gotten here before. And I think it's pretty clear that it was because the insurers, government insurers, private insurers, both really just weren't paying, right? They would pay significantly less for a digital visit versus in-person visit. And that has changed and continues to change throughout this. And it'll be really interesting to see once the pandemic is gone, and man, the news is looking better on that front, which maybe we'll get into, maybe not. But once that's gone, whether this will continue or not will be up to those insurers or the legislators who dictate how they run their business.
We are joined today by Dr. Jeremy Stopker, family practice physician at Community Health Programs in the Berkshires. And before we take a break here, we have a lot of people on the line who want to talk to you directly. But I just want to loop back to something that you brought up early. And maybe if you could just comment on the twindemic, which is a great term for something pretty horrific. And it's tangential to what has been going on with the pandemic. Maybe just talk about that for a minute.
So this has been an incredibly scary time for a lot of folks. Let's be honest, doctors included. I personally have never seen doctors so scared as at the beginning of this whole thing, where a lot of people were really afraid for their lives. more than they ever had been with anything that they have faced here in this country or in their careers. But of course, that extends to patients in many different ways. And the final comment, you know, there's lots of pathways to it, but the place that a lot of people have ended up is feeling isolated, feeling anxious, feeling depressed because they lost their job, because they can't see their relatives. You know, we've already been shifting as a society towards more social isolation. And all of a sudden, there are all these guidelines recommending that you do even more of exactly that when we've been suffering so much as a population, locally, nationally, globally, from that incredible isolation that has become a part of our modern society. And fortunately, we have our devices in some sense to connect us, but most people are feeling more scared, more isolated, more cut off from their healthcare providers, more cut off from their supports. And so there's been a massive mental health component that has accompanied this pandemic in every measurable possible way. The way we see it here is people are asking more to talk to therapists. They're asking to start antidepressants, or we're suggesting starting antidepressants, or if they're already on them, they're increasing their doses. I can think of a very few number of times in the last, I guess, now 8 or so months that I've reduced anyone's antidepressant, which we usually do tons of over the summer, at least.
It's not necessarily a good thing, though, right? Too much antidepressants in the general population, probably not the best thing, right?
Well, you know, antidepressants are a hot topic that we could easily spend 15 shows debating.
Yes.
You know, am a huge fan of all the ways to treat how people are handling things emotionally. And if they have access to getting out into nature more, I think we have great data to show that that's a great way to improve your mood. If you can connect more with other people around you, then that's going to help your mood also. If, you know, you lost your job and you get a job, then your mood is probably going to improve if you're able to pay those bills.
Yeah.
And I think it's a disservice to not consider antidepressants one of those tools. I think a big problem is when people tend to consider it the only tool.
Let's take a quick break. We have the phone lines loading up here at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. It's a Medical Monday. Dr. Jeremy Stopker is here. We'll get to your calls in a moment. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We're joined today by Dr. Jeremy Stopker, a family practice physician at Community Health Programs in the Berkshires. All right, Doc, you ready for some calls?
Let's take it.
All right, let's do it. Kathleen in Albany, you're on.
Hi, I am a retired social worker, 77 years old, and I had a H1N1 flu shot while I was working. It was given by public health. I had an allergic reaction the next day. My throat closed up. I am allergic to codeine. I'm allergic to bee stings. I have been recommended to have a flu shot, a shingles shot. The COVID shots are going to be coming along. I am very afraid to get another shot because of that allergic reaction when my throat closed up. They said it might have been from the preservative in that shot. And I'm wondering what your recommendation would be to someone like myself that had an adverse reaction to a shot like that.
Kathleen, you bring up a very, very hot topic. And without knowing every detail of your medical history, it's impossible to know what's best for you. But to just speak very generally about vaccines and people who've had significant reactions to vaccines in general, it's definitely an important thing for whoever's recommending the vaccine to know about and to talk about what would happen if you were to have that reaction again or something different. So first and foremost, whoever's going to give you that vaccine, it's super important that they know the exact details of when and what happened to you. And then you would make a plan with them. And if you felt comfortable with that plan, then you would probably go forward with it, which first and foremost should be the discussion. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that you could have that with your primary care provider, Kathleen, or you could have it with an allergist. So one thing that a lot of people will do when they've had an adverse reaction to a vaccine is go visit with an allergist and talk about what that response was, what most likely triggered it, and if there are things you could do to alleviate it from happening the next time, and whether that's finding a preservative-free flu vaccine, which is absolutely available at most clinics and oftentimes in pharmacies as well, or potentially something that we'll oftentimes have people do is actually get that vaccine in an allergist's office and just stay there for a little while afterwards. Now, your reaction is tricky because it happened a full day later, which is less common for vaccine reactions, but certainly not on the out of the realm of possibility. And you're probably not going to spend a full 24 hours at your allergist's office. I'm not aware of any that are open that long, but it wouldn't be unreasonable to have it administered at an allergist's office or at your primary care doctor's office and then stay there for a set amount of time, see what happens. And if you need treatment for whatever allergic reaction comes along, that's important. I think it's important to acknowledge that most of the vaccine reactions that people have are treatable. And what we're preventing with these illnesses are potentially fatal illnesses. Our treatments for flu are really just not that good. Some of the best way to treat the flu virus is to prevent it. And one of the best ways to prevent the flu virus is to get a vaccine. So this is a really tricky topic. There are no right answers, but hopefully that gives you a few ideas for options for ways to move forward.
Kathleen, thank you very much for the call. Well, you brought up a point that is on everybody's mind these days, especially in the last week or two, and that's vaccines. And we have now three that are allegedly over 90% effective. You, sir, will probably be in the first round whenever these are approved and ready to go, and it could be a matter of weeks now, will be those among those people who will get it first. Will you have any reservations in taking your vaccine?
I will not have any reservations in taking my vaccine, and am reassured that already tens of thousands of people have had this vaccine before me and that we'll have pretty good safety data for it. Also, for me, it's very much a risk-benefit question, right? If this vaccine means I can go to back to meeting with and hugging my relatives, then I'm willing to tackle whatever the risk of that vaccine may be, most likely a very small one. If it means it's safer for me to provide medical care to my patients because I'm less likely to give the sick people that I'm caring for this virus, then is it absolutely worth some very small amount of risk? Yeah, I think it absolutely is. And I think we sort of lose that in the conversation that we have with vaccines, is the severity and danger of the illnesses that we're preventing and the minimal risk that vaccines potentially prevent. I think a lot of people on the pro-vaccine side of the debate do a disservice to this discussion with talking about how there are very few reactions to vaccines, and I don't think that's true. In fact, if you don't have any vaccine reaction, that means it's not working very well. If you feel a little bit sick after a vaccine, that means it's activating your immune system and working, and that's a reaction, and people have that to incredibly varied degrees, and when that's dismissed, it's not helping anyone. So I think it's an incredibly hot topic, but I'll be happy to get in line and get mine sooner than later.
We're joined today by Dr. Jeremy Stopker from Community Health Programs in the Berkshires. You know, you talk about the pressure that doctors and teachers and everybody in society has been under. And anecdotally, just in looking around at your colleagues, has this word of the fast track and the success of the vaccines lightened the mood or lessened the tension level that must be palpable among many in the medical community?
When this pandemic first hit, I spent most of my weekends going down to New York City to help out in the hospital where I trained down there and have continued to do that throughout this. And I have never seen doctors in such a state of panic and anxiety and helplessness as I saw at the beginning of this. And that mood has slowly shifted over the last 8 months or so that we've been dealing with this down there and up here in Berkshire County. But nothing has had anything close to as significant an impact on that collective mood of the people that I'm interacting with as much as the news, the very positive news of potentially very effective vaccines on the horizon. People are jubilant, overjoyed, finally seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, and thrilled that we won't be dealing with nearly as much of this as we are right now, and certainly as much as we were back in March and April.
Dr. Jeremy Stopker joins us. Well, I think that your medical colleagues, you and everybody else, joins with the teachers and the students in that list of people who have some relief. Knowing a bunch of students who are in my house, and I also know a bunch of teachers, and it's just everybody says, okay, we just got to hang on, do the right thing, and maybe this will finally go away some point.
I sure hope so for the teachers and the students and for the healthcare workers and the restaurant workers and everybody else who has been putting literally their life on the line to continue to do their work despite everything that's going on. Yeah, it's really exciting to have a little bit of light shining at the end of that tunnel. Who knows how it'll all play out? I think we all are pretty clear that the next few months are going to be quite abysmal. And everyone's holding their breath with how much worse it gets after Thanksgiving. But this news definitely is boosting the collective morale.
Well, we got to say, stay strong. Let's go to Steve in Albany. Steve, you're on with Dr. Jeremy Stopker.
Hi. I have two questions. One is, if the vaccine is 90% effective, so it's 10% not effective, if you took two different vaccines, would they complement each other so that you would only have a 1% chance of being of getting the virus? And the second is, if people are immunocompromised, then they're usually told not to take a vaccine that has live virus. And which of the vaccines would be available for that?
So let's take these one at a time. Question number one is a much better question for a researcher into vaccines or an epidemiologist, not for a lowly GP such as myself. My understanding is that we're going to have a really hard time getting enough vaccine available for all the people who need it. And so I'm not sure how practical it would be to get people numerous doses of numerous different vaccines. I think we'll all be very excited to get any form of vaccine if it's effective. And I think it's also important to remember that the vaccine doesn't just protect you, but the more people get vaccinated, the harder it is for coronavirus to spread. You know, if you think about a restaurant and 10 people go in to eat in that restaurant between 5 and 6 p.m., and one person has active coronavirus that could spread to all of those other folks, if 9 of the 10 of them have had some sort of vaccine and it's 90% effective, so we're saying only one of them potentially still gets it, and let's hope that whatever infection they get is really mild, and then maybe one person in there fully gets it, then that's a whole heck of a lot better in terms of how things are going to look for everybody that knows those 10 people over the next couple of weeks, in comparison to if we had a vaccine that was 50% effective or even less, or we had trouble, you know, or very few of those people got the vaccine. So that's, you know, a very coarse way to explain the fact that not just the individual protection of a vaccine needs to be considered, but we are all safer with a lot of people getting vaccinated and the coronavirus then having a much harder time spreading to us eventually. Number two,
that would contribute to herd immunity.
Herd immunity is the sort of the topic that we're getting to here. And I think herd immunity is, you know, is a very specific part of this, but just generally the more effective a vaccine is and the more people get it, the fewer people are transmitting coronavirus and the safer all of us are. one of the trickiest things about the coronavirus is that it's really, really, really contagious. That's why it's spreading so ragingly fast, because it can get across a restaurant pretty easily. And the more effective a vaccine is, that's, I think, to be taken into consideration, not just with how it protects that individual person, but with our herd immunity and as a society. Number two, again, I'm not an immunologist versed in the intricacies of vaccines, but my understanding is that most of the vaccines that are being produced are using relatively new technology that has been used in some other approaches to vaccines, but not on as grand a scale as this, and that it's not a live attenuated virus that they're considering using in these vaccines, but a very different approach, which is looking really good and exciting on lots of levels. That we now have an approach, and maybe to be applicable to other viruses down the road. Wouldn't that be awesome also? If this pandemic, another silver lining of this pandemic was to improve our vaccine technology to cover potentially illnesses that haven't been vaccinatable up until this point, that would be really great. So I don't think the issues with a live vaccine are going to be a problem with this specific vaccine. So, and I think we would all very much like for those people who are immunocompromised to be some of the first people vaccinated, because they're some of the most vulnerable to the coronavirus.
Steve, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Jeremy Stopker is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551 on this Medical Monday. 1-800-348-2551. Without violating any HIPAA rules here, I would assume that you have dealt with some patients who have come in with symptoms that present very similar to COVID and then end up maybe perhaps being COVID-19. With regard to the kids, we have heard, we have read that children present symptoms a little differently. Are you seeing that at your practice?
Well, I think one of the trickiest things about the coronavirus is that we think maybe half of kids don't have any symptoms at all. And that statistic has fluctuated throughout with what little research we've gotten on this. But yeah, as a parent with kids in school, this is a really tricky topic. As somebody who's been discussing it with my school and how we should set up our, our recommendations and guidelines around this, it's been really complicated because kids are a tricky population when it comes to the coronavirus. Number one, it really seems like they don't get nearly as sick. Certainly, thank goodness, they're wildly less likely to die from it, which is awesome, especially, as a parent of young kids.
Yeah.
That feels really good, which I think you can relate to also,
yes,
Ray.
Indeed.
They also seem to spread it less. And that, in my mind, makes a ton of sense. If they're fighting it off better and quicker than the older people, then they're probably just going to have fewer copies that they have available to spread to people. So if somebody who is ragingly racked by gajillions of copies of the coronavirus, every time they sneeze, they're going to be putting a lot more of them out into the air than somebody whose immune system is doing a really awesome job of crushing it. And when they sneeze, there are very few copies of the coronavirus, at least into the air. And that's me just presuming some mechanism. I'm not really sure. I don't think we have the research to know how this doesn't transmit as well amongst kids, but man, as somebody who would really like to keep my kids in school, I'm thrilled every time I see more reports about the fact that that is the case.
I hear
kids
that.
Are less likely to transmit it. They're less likely to get sick from it. They're less likely to die from it. All great things.
Dr. Jeremy Stopker, our guest today. Let's grab one more call before the next break. 800-348-2551 is the number on Medical Monday. Jim is in Matamoros. Jim.
Concerning the post-acute COVID syndrome, can the later symptoms present with more severe lesions than the initial disease?
Super controversial topic, right, Jim? So we know so little about this. We've seen the multisystem inflammatory response that some kids have had. But in terms of the syndromes, which is a term that, you know, we oftentimes use when we totally don't understand what's going on, but the syndromes that are presenting after COVID. Again, I'm no specialist in this. I'm trying to keep up as much as I can with what is coming out in the news on it. But yeah, people are having some really devastating things happen after their coronavirus infection. This, you know, is always going to be a controversial topic because it's really hard to know what's causing what. And who knows if some of these cases are things that would have happened to this person anyway, regardless of whether they had coronavirus or if they're directly a cause of the coronavirus and how. We haven't had this virus around very long to study and to learn about these things. Certainly one of the things we've been seeing a lot of in the hospital is people with unusual blood clots. And we're learning every day. There are big studies that are being conducted now about the best way to prevent that. Learning why it happens is a much trickier thing, and I don't think we're going to know for a very long time. But yes, I definitely have seen patients and heard about cases where the effects after the coronavirus were vastly more devastating than the episode of the coronavirus itself, and that's a scary, terrible thing. And again, something that sort of goes back to the vaccine debate of one of the things that is a really nice side effect of the vaccines is that, yes, you probably aren't low risk to get a severe coronavirus, but if you get the vaccine, you prevent it, then, man, it'd be really nice if you weren't one of the people to get one of those scary post-coronavirus syndromes.
Dr. Jeremy Stopker is our guest. Jim, thanks for the call. We'll take a quick break here, get back to the calls, and we'll open the email bag in a moment. 800-348-2551 is our number. We'll be right back. Vox Pop, Medical Monday on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is our telephone number, and Dr. Jeremy Stopker is our guest today. We have a few emails here, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one's from Rob in Western Massachusetts. Please remind the good doctor that there is no such thing as a lowly general practitioner, as he just referred to himself as, and also remind him how many people take comfort in just listening to his educated answers. And Rob, thanks you for all you do.
Thanks, Rob. My wife, I think, would argue that you're working to make my already swollen head even bigger, which is dangerous.
All right, fair
might
enough.
Explode.
All right, this is a funny one, and we have a regular correspondent, Mark, who often gives us an interesting angle. Mark writes, when most of us were growing up, there was no internet. Now anybody with a smartphone can look up just about anything in seconds. As a doctor, how do you feel about patients looking up medical information regarding their potential conditions as long as it's not an emergency? Is consultation with Dr. Google really all that bad? And that's from Mark.
Man, again, we could do a whole show on this, right? I personally, having only practiced in the internet era, I finished medical school in 2004. I got my first cell phone shortly before that, and it was a much beloved Trio handspring that could even do some rudimentary emailing and note taking. And it, you know, the technology has matured as I've matured in this career, and so I've never known anything other than patients coming in having already consulted Dr. Google. And I think in some senses it can cause some problems, right? Just like the coronavirus can, it can trigger some anxiety, and that can be a huge problem if it's already a problem for that person. But I think it also can do a great service of getting people thinking about things other than what they already knew, and thinking outside the box when it comes to complicated conditions, or connecting with other people who may have similar symptoms and had a really hard time finding it out. So yes, do I every once in a while have a gut reaction while I'm talking about a patient or talking to a patient and they say, hey, well, Google thought it was probably this.
Yeah.
And yes, am I sometimes offended that people put more stake in something that they Googled for maybe 15 to 20 minutes versus something that I've been studying for basically the entirety of my life at this stage in the game? But I've never considered it my role as, I guess I shouldn't use the word lowly GP, but as a GP, to be the world's leading expert on anything. In fact, I think when I signed on for this part of medicine, I realized that I never was going to be, and I was only ever going to work collaboratively with patients. And if I'm working collaboratively with patients, then I'm oftentimes working collaboratively with their family members. And now in the modern era, I'm working collaboratively with whoever they've connected with on the internet or with whatever they found on Google. And if, you know, that's really hard for me, then I'm probably in the wrong specialty, but I still love showing up at work every day. So I don't think that's the case.
You know, you mentioned the tremendous stress that everyone has been under. And one of the things that I have seen is since this has begun in March or whenever it hit the national consciousness, there's been an awful lot of very wrong information out there. And one thing that I've noticed with kids is they're connected to the internet. And they have sometimes trouble filtering what is real and what is not real with pandemic information. Are you seeing a stress level in kids that you have not seen before in your practice?
That's a great question, Ray. No. I think the short answer is actually no. I think the families that I've been taking care of have been doing a pretty good job of having the important and oftentimes challenging conversations with what's going on, how it's going on. I think it's also great that kids aren't getting as sick and dying of it, and that makes it easier for the kids to sort of say, yes, this is scary, but hopefully it's not scary specifically for me. I think the most connected kids are the kids who come to see their GP the least, and those are teenagers, right? So yeah. I think this is almost certainly disproportionately affecting teenagers. And is teenage anxiety increased with the pandemic? Oh, heck yeah, for sure. With the, you know, this is an incredibly important time to be connected to your peers. And all of a sudden, everyone is saying that you're not allowed to hang out with your peers. And that's really hard, or that you can't go to, you know, your graduation or your prom. So, I think I see more in the news than I see specifically with my patients, and I imagine more of that going on than I've actually experienced in the patients that I've been seeing in the last 8 months. But I think that's partially just due to the fact that teenagers don't see their doctor all that often. And part of that is because they usually, whenever they have problems, they don't go to their doctor, they don't go to their parents, they go to their friends. And in some senses, that's a really healthy thing, right? That's the time of their life where they're supposed to really start making those connections and reaching outside of their circles and connecting with other people in that way. It's just been a lot harder with the pandemic. And man, I really feel for them in that sense. I'm really happy not to be a senior in high school this year.
Dr. Jeremy Stopker is our guest, and I second that emotion. All right, back to the phones we go. We have several more emails. We'll try to get to a few more here before we wrap up. But let's go to Lorraine, who is on the Mass Pike. Lorraine, you're on with Dr. Jeremy Stopker.
Yes, doctor. I just had an incident, and what triggered me to call you was that you talked about the stress during this pandemic, and I don't think people take it serious enough. How does one decide to get professional help when they're triggered by the stress of the COVID, and how can they identify it? Right now, I mean, I was just like verbally and physically abused, and that's why I left the Berkshires. I'm on the Mass Pike, and I've pulled over, and I'm shocked that I got through to you. I mean, I've got two bumps on my head, cuts on my hand. The person went wild over a small little item, and I was begging the person to leave me alone and ripping my clothes and pushing me around, throwing me. I mean, I've known this person 6.5 years. And I guess the stress, the person's 70, and the stress is just like too much for people. What do you do? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I have a doctor. I'm just lost right now. I just knew that I needed to exit, and I'm just heading out of town. What do people do with all this stress, or how do people identify, or is there enough out there to say, you need help, somebody?
Well, Lorraine, it certainly sounds like you could use some help with this situation, and the person that you were dealing with most certainly desperately needs help. I'll first make a quick plug for the Elizabeth Freeman Center, which is an amazing organization in Berkshire County that deals with people who are abused, and they're a great resource and a great safe space that I highly recommend. And I'm so thrilled to hear that you were able to escape that situation and are doing the most important thing, which is taking care of your own safety. And I do hope that you're able to get help with this situation, be it from your primary care provider if you have one, or the police certainly seem appropriate in a scenario like this. But let's get to the question that you're actually asking, which is, how do you know if the stress of the COVID, to quote you directly, is too much to handle? And I think it's been too much to handle all of us, and we could all use a little help with this. And where we get that is going to be different for all of us. Where some people get it is going to be from going for a hike, and where some people get that help from is going to be from their immediate family members and talking it out, or some other relatives or their friends. And when you need professional help with this, I think the easiest benchmark that I've ever come up with in my career is when whatever it is that you're trying to do isn't enough. It's not helping you through whatever it is that you're dealing with enough, as one measure. And then another measure is just if it's having any sort of a significant impact on your ability to live the life that you want to live, to achieve, you know, the goals that you're trying to achieve. If this is standing in the way, if the stress of the COVID is standing in the way of that, then potentially some professional help is absolutely warranted and makes a ton of sense. Getting that professional help right now in the time of COVID is unfortunately incredibly difficult. The wait list for therapists, especially therapists who take insurance, are higher than they've been since I've been practicing here in the Berkshires. And a frustration that so many of us in healthcare feel is that not only do we have the barrier of when people are ready to get help, but the additional barrier of being able to get them the help that they need when they're ready for it. So those mm-hmm. are really huge sources of frustration. Again, Lorraine, I'm so glad that you were able to get out of this really scary, dangerous situation. Please seek out.
I am too. And I like what you said. You know, it's important to live the life you want to live. And there's always, like, when is there a readiness to admit or accept? I don't think in this situation, or most often, I don't think police is the answer. I think more the therapy, and I have enough tools in, you know, psychology or spirituality or meditation to move forward and eventually reconnect with my therapist, who I haven't seen in 8 months. But I like what you said. If you can't live the life you want to live, you've got to make the changes and do the tough stuff. Thank you very much for your guidance in this one and listening.
It's such a pleasure. Maybe, maybe Lorraine, we can talk. Kathleen, the retired social worker we talked to earlier in the show to come out of retirement, or there's some others out there who want to step forward and help out with this twindemic, as we were then discussing it, of the mental health challenges of coronavirus, as well as the physical health challenges that we're seeing. It's a really, really scary time for a lot of people. It sounds like you in particular right now. And I'm thrilled to hear that you have a therapist, hopefully you can reconnect with and sort through this. It's also such a tricky thing when it's not, you know, it's not just you that you're dealing with. There's another person, and, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink, I think applies to so many things in life. And making sure you're taking care of you seems like a top priority in a situation like this. And I'm thrilled to hear that you're doing so. Good luck, Lorraine.
Lorraine, thank you so much for calling. Dr. Jeremy Stopker, our guest. And doctor, I'll tell you, you know, when you were here last October, you were here in person, and you sort of got my hand cues when we were about to end the show. We have about 2.5 minutes here. So when you hear Count Basie start playing the piano, we're going to wrap it up, okay?
That sounds like a plan.
All right, let's
go. Looking forward to being back in that studio with you once we both get our vaccines in a few months, Ray.
I agree. Let's go to Howard in New Paltz. Howard, can you turn your radio down, sir? Oh, boy. Okay. This is not a good way to end the show. It's not. Howard, are you there? All right, that's it. Well, I'm sorry, doctor. I lose patience. You when you're listening at home, you have to have your radio off. You listen on the phone when you're calling in. Is there anything in the last minute and a half that you would like to share with us about this? And frankly, I think you've been eloquent on a number of topics today regarding society and medicine and the pandemic and how we are all faring. You mentioned there are some rough months ahead. I think that's a consensus among all of us. Any wisdom you can share in the last 90 seconds or so?
I think there's a lot we can do to have less roughness ahead, if that's a weird way to say it. You know, please, everyone, wear your masks. Please stay out of indoor areas where there are a lot of people with masks off. You know, if you are going to be inside, please have your mask on. If you're going to be in a crowded public area, please have your mask on. Please limit your travel for Thanksgiving. Please limit the people that you're around. We are getting some light at the end of the tunnel. It's really exciting. And I think our journey from here until that light can be really bumpy or less bumpy. And it's really up to us as individuals ultimately to do what not only keeps us safe, but what keeps the most vulnerable in society safe, right? That mask is not just for you. This vaccine is not just for you. It's for those people out there who need the protection potentially more than we do. So let's all sort of gather together as a community and do everything we can to keep all of us as safe as we possibly can in what's going to be a really dangerous winter. I desperately hope people will step up and take the personal responsibility to do that as much as they possibly can. I know we're all feeling some COVID fatigue and just desperately want to throw it all out the window and take whatever risks there may be of getting this thing and start living our lives again. But if we can just hang on a few more months, it does seem like we will get through this thing, and we'll get through it in much better shape with way less sickness and post-COVID syndromes and death if we all just follow some very basic guidelines in these next few months. So just please, everyone, as much as you possibly can, let's do that all together a little bit longer.
Hey, Matt, great job. Thank you. So well put. We appreciate you being here. Next time, we'll see you in the studio, okay?
Looking forward to it, Ray. Thanks again so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure.
We'll talk to you soon. Support comes from Berkshire Orthopedic Associates, an affiliate of Berkshire Health Systems, providing orthopedic services in the Berkshires, including Mako robotic surgery, sports medicine, and anterior hip surgery. 413-499-6600. Once again, thanks to Dr. Jeremy Stopker of Community Health Programs in the Berkshires for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Sorry if we didn't get to your call or your email. Doctor will be back again soon. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, our producer, Jackie Orchard. Phones answered by Kayleen White. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's the Copyright Forum. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. here. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.